That's really all intelligence is data points. The more data points you and I have to link and correlate an experience, the more intelligent we are. So that's why there are some people that I admire who have sayings like, if you can see it, you can be it. If you can understand how it operates, if you can see it, whether it's in your mind or in reality, if you can envision it, you're closer to being able to do it. That's a really, really important concept. And so that's why young students are taken to see masters perform on the piano or on the oboe or the cello or whatever. They're exposed to people who are performing at such a high level that they say, oh, I see how that's done. I can do that now. I've seen another human being. It's not just an MP3 file that I'm listening to. There's a real person making that.
Yeah.
It's much more tangible. That's why I think, you know, in the project management world, mentorship is so important.
Hi, and welcome to the Sunday Lunch Project Manager podcast for Sunday, the 15th of January, 2023. This is your host, Nigel Creaser, and today we've got the second part of my interview with Greg Offner, the piano guy.
Me is there's creativity in everything, and I think and I've said this on the show before, if people who listen to this are probably bored of it, is you've got that your base skills, your technical skills of project management that anyone can learn. You've got your technical skills of a musician, you know your scales, and then you can learn other pieces and stuff. But I talk about chiseling, Venus de Milo. You can do all of the techniques for creating a piece of artwork, for all of the techniques for creating skin texture, for hair texture, whatever. You may be brilliant at all those, but putting them all together into something that is a piece of art, is a good piece of music, that is a brilliantly put together project plan. All these things you can, project delivery, sorry. I see that there's this art element that sits across it. And it's about using those tools, using the techniques in the PMBOK and all those sort of things. But you've kind of got to get your own style and get your own, learn that whole way of doing it, and little tips and tricks from other people, which isn't taught. You can't teach it, because the way that I build a relationship with a stakeholder compared to someone else building a relationship with a stakeholder will be different, because we're different humans. And sometimes I'll use some of the tools and techniques they'd use. Sometimes they'd use the tools and techniques I'd use in the style. But there will be something subtly different. There will be you about it. And I think it's, and that's where the creativity comes into all of our jobs, I think. And it's like you were saying with your sales techniques. You'll have read Napoleon Hill and read the guy, the insurance salesman, Jim Betcher or something like that. There was a book from many years ago. He's the guy, I can't remember his name. I've read it myself. I'm sure it was the guy who sold it. He went somewhere and one of his teachers said to one of his, when he went for an interview, he said, well, sell me that ashtray. And he basically didn't sell him the ashtray. He sold him the need that he had rather than the ashtray. That's the basic thing. But again, it was... you can learn all those techniques, but then you're going to put your spin on it and your style on it and your relationship building and of who you are and your creativity. And that's why I think sometimes we get knocked out of us, don't we?
Well, yes. And the issue of legacy knowledge has become a really interesting one right now. Because what you're talking about in terms of you have to see someone else do it, you can't pick it up on your own. I mean, it's harder to pick it up on your own, but not all musicians see someone play every piece they've ever played before. What they have are they have these foundational elements, these building blocks of musical creativity. So they are the scales, they are rhythm, they are harmony. So without getting super musical, music and technical, you know, there are the circle of fourths, the circle of fifths. There are these different theory elements to music that once you understand them, allow you to be more intentionally creative. There are people who are accidentally creative. I mean, you know, the elephant who paints a work of art. Is that intentional? Is it accidental? Who's to say? But when the musician is building that foundation, I'd argue that the skills within the foundation are less important than the real, the sort of hidden skill that they're building, which is the ability to learn, unlearn, and relearn quickly. And it's funny that you say that school does sort of grade us and put us into neat little boxes for someone else to be able to select from. But if there's anything that school should really be prized or proud of itself for teaching, it should be the ability to learn, unlearn, and relearn. Except they're not doing that. It's the ability to memorize, which isn't the same thing as learning. That's just remember. The ability to memorize, forget, and then re-memorize all over again. It's not the same thing as learning. There's an internalization process when it comes to learning. When it comes to music, there's muscle memory that's associated with those scales. And it's shown that folks who are in Alzheimer's wards, who can't remember their name or their children's names or the first kiss, they remember a piece of music. They're alivened. They're awakened. I mean, there's a, so our daughter's 20 months old. There is a movie called Coco that's out right now that's all about, you know, a father who disappeared. I won't just spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen Coco yet. Or if you're a parent, you're like, I've seen it 5,000 times. Shut up, Greg.
It's a good film.
There's a bit at the end, right, where Mama Coco is catatonic, basically, throughout this whole movie. And then thanks to a song, she's reconnected with her childhood and comes to life. It's moving. And so the skill that musicians learn, the skill that I teach some of my clients, in fact, I call it the performer's process. It's we learn something, then we practice it, then we rehearse it, and then we perform it. And what I found in the corporate world is that folks learn and then go perform. There's no practice and there's no rehearsal. Practice is when we break a piece of music or we break a skill or a concept down into manageable parts. So in a musical piece, you might practice the first few measures, the next few measures. You might practice the verse, then the chorus, then the verse, then the chorus. But you're breaking that whole 3 minute, or if it's, you know, a classical piece, it could be 10 minutes long. You're breaking that whole piece down into a more manageable part so you can practice it. And then you get good at the first part and you link that to the second part. But then we got to rehearse. Because to take something we've practiced and then just go put it on stage opens up the door to a lot of variables. And you can see these if you Google piano recital gone wrong. All sorts of funny things happen. A leg on the bench falls out from under you and you go toppling over. Maybe the piano sustain pedal isn't working. Whatever. Issues happen. In real life, in the work world, in the real world, issues happen. So we want to not only practice the skills and the competencies that are important for our role, but we want to rehearse them in tougher than real life situations. So if real life is just assume things are going to go as per usual in a sales call, when I'm rehearsing with a team what a sales call might look like, we might be flipping the lights on and off trying to distract people. We might have someone go stand in the corner and pretend to have a really loud or boisterous phone call while the person we're rehearsing with is rehearsing their sales pitch. Because if they can do it under those challenging circumstances, they're going to do it in the real world. They're going to enjoy the performance. But we're not teaching that in schools, most schools. We're not teaching that in the professional world. So I'm sort of like at a loss to understand why we're spending 98% of $300 billion developing people within roles they may not actually like, skills that may not ever transfer to roles that they find themselves in next, and only 2% of the time developing what would really get their engagement, what would really get them laser focused and enjoying and fulfilled by their job, which is those aspirational skills of curiosity, drive, energy management. You know, employees show up to work exhausted or financially drained. I sold uniforms for a little while. Here's how this relates. I promise it'll relate. I sold uniform services, textiles to, you know, machinists and manufacturing plants. And we had a saying, what do you think about when your pants are too tight? We'd ask our clients that, you know, because they'd be a little bit hesitant to switch from their current uniform provider. And I'd say, what do you think about when your pants are too tight? And they give you a funny look. And they ultimately say, well, nothing. I'm thinking about my pants being too tight. When you have an employee showing up to work that's financially out of energy, they're not thinking about work. They're thinking about their bills. That's the tightening of the fiscal belt, if you will. So we spend no time, most organizations spend no time, teaching and developing financial skills, financial energy, teaching these emotional skills, emotional energy. How do I deal with stress and frustration? We just assume, oh, that's something you should learn as you're growing up. Yeah, but look around. People haven't learned that. They're clearly bringing these issues into the workplace with them. And it's not only causing the work to suffer, it's causing the worker to suffer. And it's a problem we've got. I'll get off my soapbox in 1 second. It's a problem we've already got the financial resources to address. And a study out of the UK a couple of years ago showed that most employees, they surveyed 2,000 employees, and most of them said they actually worked about 3.5 hours a day. That the rest of the time was kind of just goofing off, killing time, long lunch, leisurely walk back to the office, head out for a smoke, head out for a coffee, go visit a coworker at their desk. So we've got the financial energy at work that's being spent already. We could redirect. We've got the time. I mean, this training doesn't, you know, we're not going to go into 4 hour a day training. This is maybe 1 hour a week we add this training in. We've got the desire. In a recent survey, employees said they wanted three things. Three things would make them engage more. More money, of course. Who doesn't want that? More time off. Of course, who doesn't want that? More opportunities to develop myself professionally. Not the role I'm in, but roles that I could qualify for in the future. So we've got the need, the money, the time. What are we waiting for, my friends? What are we waiting for?
I understand that. Yeah, it's funny. It's funny because it's quite serendipitous that quite often that I'll have these conversations, and then recently I'll have been listening, and maybe it's just common things that I'll be listening to something or reading something that is related. But I was listening to a podcast, the Manager Tool podcast. Again, another mention to those guys. Brilliant podcast. And they were talking. They were interviewing a lady. And I can't remember her name, and I can't remember her podcast. And it's quite unusual for them to have. I think they've been going 17 years, and they've had 5 people as guests. So that's how highly they hold this particular woman's advice. And it's all about financial. It's something FIRE, I think, financial independence, retire early, or something like that. It was her podcast that they had her on. But what they're talking about is how important it is to businesses and to managers to educate your staff and your employees about being financially stable. Because exactly as you said there, if you don't, it will affect your business, because you will not get the best them in there. You're not going to have their full attention. You're not going to have their full energy. They may be not sleeping at night. They may be trying to think, how am I going to do this? And I think the great thing that they brought out of there was not just stability. If all of your employees are financially independent, and that doesn't mean that they're like multimillionaires, it just means that 3 months from now, if they lost their job, they wouldn't be worried. They'd be able to do something for 3 months, they'd be fine. They wouldn't be worrying where they pay the next bills. It changes the decisions that they make while doing their job, because they're not worried about getting sacked because they're stable and safe outside of the organization isn't their be all and end all to feed their children next week. They can go there and go and take risks in some ways of saying career risks of standing up and saying the right thing rather than the safe thing. And exactly what you're saying there, if we train people in that way and people are more stable, and same with health as well, because then if your health and you've got the energy, physical energy and health, you're going to be a better employee. You're going to be able to do better because you're not worrying, you're not under energy. So it kind of goes back to some of the stewardship that the the mill owners in the 1800s had in some ways, in that they kind of looked after the whole person who was their employee. They provided them a house. Now, I'm not suggesting we should go back to that basis of operations and employment, but some of the more forward-thinking ones were the Bournevilles and people like that, and the guys up in Lanark in Scotland, where they built an environment. They provided time off, they provided health care, they provided all care for the children and things like that. And I wonder whether we're moving back to that, and whether we should be moving back to more of that support of when you come to a business, you're supporting the whole person, not just for those 8 hours when you've taken a lump of fat out of them to deliver something for you. What do you think on that, that kind of that view?
So I'm thinking about a watch company in France from the 1950s, Beaumondo, I believe, and I'm probably butchering the name, just seeing if I could Google it real quick. But anyway, they took a very paternalistic approach to management, and not just, and some of that wouldn't be appropriate in today's world. But what was fascinating was that they really democratized the decision-making of the companies. And we're seeing this idea sort of put forward now that perhaps there should be two forms of selection for managers and leaders. One obviously needs to be the senior leadership of the company deciding, yes, we believe you're a good leader. But perhaps there should be a much larger voice of the subordinate and of the entry-level worker, if you will, in deciding, yeah, is this someone that we should raise to the level of a senior manager? Is this someone who we would follow? And I see this a lot with sales organizations where the best sales performer becomes the sales manager. And I think you'd find if you ask many sales teams, that person may not be the one that they would follow. It may be the person they wish they had the sales results of, but they may not be the best leader for the job.
Yeah, and as an organization, they may not be the right person, because if they are the best salesperson, use them doing the thing that they're the best at, not managing people. Like, they may be able to educate and mentor people in the teams, but actually, if they're brilliant at selling, reward them well. I know of one organization, I was talking to someone, and they were the CIO or something, and they said, yeah, sales guy, X job. He earns 5 times as much as me. Do you know what I mean? He's the guy who owns the company, comfortably paying someone 5 times more than he earns, because he knows that without that, the organization doesn't get it. And that's the person. And you don't want to take those key performers sometimes. And we all rise up to managers in project management. Quite a few of us come into it from key skills in an area, IT especially. And you're not necessarily trained in how to manage people. You're trained in those technical skills and kind of interacting with people. And then suddenly you're having to tell people what to do. And there's a book called, I think it's Boss to Bud or Bud to Boss or something like that. There's so much mindset. And you talked about mindset already. It's so much more mindset change than skill change sometimes. And that's the bit that's harder to, you can pick up a new skill. You can use it. But your mindset and dealing with that change of how everybody else sees you and how you see everybody else is something that is not always trained in very well historically. I think in some cases it is better now, but certainly historically from my experience moving into management roles, I didn't really get quite get anything to do with the mindset in the way I had to think differently.
Yeah, even in managerial roles, that disparity of how training and development is applied, that what I was speaking to earlier, that 2%, the soft skill development, the executive coaching, I mean, that really is reserved for the folks who hit director and sort of VP, or depending on the size of the company, senior VP and above level, which generally takes somewhere between 6 to 8 years to achieve, which means that we've got 8 years of every professional's life, assuming they stay at the same company, where they're being underdeveloped. And if you look at the footballer you mentioned earlier, I love ice hockey. So if you look at the NHL or you look at ice hockey in general around the world, you know, even 5-year-olds have hockey coaches. They have coaches. And you get to the pro league and you have several coaches. Now, How many coaches do most people have at work? None. Maybe one if you're in a director role and they assign you an executive coach. But in every other aspect of whether it's music, you've got your teachers, right? Those are your coaches. If it's ballet, you have your dance instructors. You know, whatever it is, you've got coaches, but not in the thing that keeps the world running. I mean, business is a great thing.
Yeah.
I love the idea of business as the face of change on the planet. It's better than any government, clearly. You know, business can do change better when it's done ethically. When it's done ethically and consciously, business does it better. Better than the government, better than nonprofits, better than anybody. Better than a single, you know, multi-billionaire human being. Business can do it better. But only when we're fully developing our people. Only when we're getting the most out of the resources within our organization. It's sort of like if you have a gorgeous sports car. I mean, whatever your favorite color, mine's blue. Gorgeous, sexy paint job. The leather inside, it's like rich Italian. It's like butter when you touch it. Oh, it's amazing. And the stereo system and the electronics are, they're unbelievable. They're the best you've ever seen. Everything's in the right place. There's so much attention to detail. But there's no engine. What's that car really worth? Looks sexy, looks pretty, okay. But what's it really worth? And I don't mean to disparage anyone when I say this, but if your brain is your engine, folks, how many of us really know how to use it?
Yeah.
I mean, do we really understand how our brain works? Because that's not knowledge that school is telling us is valuable unless you study psychology or philosophy. Because all we're supposed to do, remember we said this earlier, is get the test done so that we can get sorted into a more appropriate box. But that's not what's happening nowadays. Now with what we're in, you know, the knowledge economy, and there's part of the gig economy that's starting to creep up, a lot of these sort of rote tasks are being outsourced to AI or to computer programming or to algorithms. So what we really need to do to continue to be valuable to organizations is to be able to think, to use our brain better than the person standing to our left or to our right. Most of that doesn't come from job-specific training. It comes from those foundational, or what I call aspirational skills. Creativity, curiosity, gratitude. And gratitude is shown to extend lives. Gratitude helps us live on average 10 years longer than folks who are more pessimistic in their outlook on life. There's a great study called the Nun Study that you can Google. And it's from the Annals of Positive Psychology, where they talk about that. That they analyzed the diaries of this cloister of nuns. And what they found was when they were looking for positive or negative affect in terms of the sentiment, you know, how they expressed their outlook on life and what they went through each day, the nuns who had more of a positive affect lived on average 10 years longer. I mean, we don't teach that.
No. It's interesting that it's with the pandemic and the rise of mental health problems over the past, or I think it is the rise, but it's also the recognition of mental health problems as being the reduction of stigma and things like that. And I know my little one, she struggled with a bit of anxiety, and great book, Steve Peters, Chimp Paradox, he's done one for children as well. And it's all about the how your brain works. And as you said about the brain, and she's not learned that from school. She's learned that because of a intervention of there. And actually, I just kind of sit there and go, well, as a kid, as a, even in primary school, learning how your brain, like they'll do things about how your physiology works, how your muscles work and all that. But actually delving into how that brain works and how things will trigger anxiety, things will trigger this, trigger that, and having those tools and techniques and understanding how, and to be fair, the school where we are, they've had some general training happening there, but it's not part of the curriculum, that's part of the mental health program. And you kind of think, again, what's the school for? Is the school for educating the kid fully? because there's some responsibility on us as parents, but we don't know these things. And there's some stuff like that, mental health, that you don't know unless, like, I know these things now because I've gone through it with her and helped her with it. And I've listened to the audible book of Stephen Peters' book as well, and it's helped me with some stuff. And it just contextualizes it, but it's can we use those, teach those creativity for the sake of creativity, teaching about how the brain works and getting everyone to learn that. And I don't know, just springing off on different angles here at the minute. I'm thinking it's just popping out because I had a guy on called Simon Dutton talking about Lego Serious Play, which again, is a fantastic concept. And I've seen it work with some groups that we had there. And just that whole thing of opening up that creativity and breaking down those barriers of using other things than you'd normally use in the business environment.
That's why I use a piano in my keynotes. Yeah. You know, when you see me speaking at a conference, of course I enjoy performing. And I know that the audience enjoys that it's breaking the monotony of what is normally, you know, a talking head circus. Yeah. But really, it's because it doesn't just break the monotony, it breaks their patterns. And if I can break their patterns, I can get them to not only be open to a different idea, but remember more of what I'm sharing, because music activates the amygdala and the hippocampus, which are two areas in our brain that are responsible for creativity and memory. So when I create that opening and then I share some thoughts and ideas, now they're going to retain it. They're more open to considering these different viewpoints. And then we play another song and then we speak a little bit, and then we play another song and speak a little bit. And so what we're creating is not just an entertaining and engaging experience. We're creating deeper learning. And that's really what I think we're all striving for, is as things move quickly in life and all these different expectations are thrown at us, we really want the opportunity to pause and reflect and be able to learn a bit more deeply, you know, whatever it is that's being thrown at us, versus just, oh, it's just another thing I got to memorize, get through the next test.
Brilliant. I've seen things where they do the icebreaker sessions in some of the large groups where we have a large plenary, and then we're breaking out into groups and they'll do icebreakers, and it's really entertaining watching. I quite enjoy them. I'll get in there, I'll play games, that's fine. And there's other people who like that, sat with their arms up, they're just arms folded and just not engaging at all. And I kind of sit there and go, yeah, I understand it. And I know some of these guys, and they'll be saying to me, you're really stupid, no point doing this, we've got this emails to deal with or whatever. And the thing is, I think it's modifying someone's brain one way or another. It's different to what it would be if we were in an office in a meeting room. The fact we're in a room and we're stood up talking, moaning about it, they're going to be thinking differently. They may not be as fully open and as someone who's into it, but they'll probably be paying more attention than I would be. But it's different to what, and it's, as you say, by using something different, you break down that emotional thing, whether it's, you know, I remember I was really pissed off when we were talking about this, and this. And it's kind of like, yeah, well, it's work then, isn't it? Because the idea is to stick and retain it, and they remember it because of that emotional connection with it, positive or negative.
Here in the US, we've got this commercial, and it's a bunch of kids. It's on the radio, and they are horribly out of tune, and all they're singing is 1-877 cars for kids, KARS cars for kids, and I hate it, but I remember it. I remember it, and that's the whole point of the ad, you know.
Yeah. It isn't about being one way or the other. It's about being different sometimes for people to be able to remember stuff and an emotional connection, isn't it?
Yeah. There's a fellow speaker named Sally Hogshead who talks about different is better.
Yeah.
You know, better is good, but different is better.
Yeah. I saw that was David J. Phillips talking about presentations about the and about the fact that, I think it was him who said it, is the fact that you're not going to be the best presenter. 99.99999% of the people are not going to be the best presenter when you're doing a presentation. So be good and be different and memorable. And that's kind of what they talk about. And that's what you say. Mm-hmm. You stand out, you be different, and it'll, as long as you, it's quality. The next step is don't try to be the best. And that's, I think it's really good advice.
People have this obsession with the best. And I think it is sort of like an obsession with perfect.
Yeah.
And perfect is sort of like the lowest standard, actually, because you never reach it. And I think best is also a very, best as a goal is a disservice. We want to be the best in our industry. Okay, what'll happen then? What will that allow you to do? Well, make more money. Well, then you really want to make more money. You don't give a shit about being the best in your, sorry, you don't care about being the best in your industry. That's it's disingenuous. I would prefer an organization that shoots for, we want to be among the best in our industry. Great. Shoot for the top. You can always get better. Yeah. We can always improve. But when we are obsessed with being the best, we not only do things that aren't in service of our customer, we do things that maybe aren't in our best interest. We take shortcuts. We cheat. Break, not bend the rules. Yeah. So I really wish more people would strive for good, or rather strive for better than they were yesterday. Instead of judging themselves against everyone else, just judge yourself against yesterday. Was today better than yesterday? Good. Keep it up.
That's it. I've heard the phrase, perfect is the enemy of good. And it's that 80-20 rule thing, isn't it? 80% of the value you get, once you've got to 80% value of something, the next 20%, is it hard work and is expensive and is difficult to get up to there? It's if you want to be the best pianist in the world, let's use that, yeah? The thing you have to do to be that best pianist in the world is astounding. If you want to be a brilliant pianist, a good pianist, a great pianist, you haven't got it. It's much lower level, isn't it? And as you say, if you say, I want to be the best in the world, well, that's a lot of commitment and a lot of sacrifices in order to do that. It's like me trying to be the best podcast host in the world. I'm not sure that'll ever happen. one of my earpods just fell out. So we're just coming up on time. I think we're where we are. Is there anything that you, in these sort of conversations that you'd normally want to chat about that we haven't covered? I know we've gone down a few different rabbit holes today.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about a lot of it, eh? So I think that what might be the most valuable thing to just mention is that if we transform the people within our team, within our project, within our organization, they will transform the business for us. I work with a lot of business owners who bring me in because they want to grow or because they're in the midst of the growing pains that come with transformational growth. And so they want their people better equipped to navigate that change and disruption. And what I find when we dig into how they've been developing and preparing their people is that it's very operationally focused. So any leader that's listening to this, whether you lead a team or whether you just lead the person you see in the mirror, I believe we're all leaders. Yeah. So whether it's the person you see in the mirror that you're responsible for or many people that you're leading, find opportunities to transform the person, to be all that they can be. The reason that slogan worked so well for the U.S. Army is because if it had said, well, be the best marksman you can be, okay, that might appeal to a few people. Or, you know, be the best combat soldier you can be. All right, that might appeal to a few people. But be all that you can be is not only individual, but it's got broad appeal. Yeah. Every person within our organization, whether it's the person we see in the mirror or the people we lead every day, there's something that they want for themselves, for their life. Can we give them skills? Can we help them transform into the type of person that gets closer to whatever that goal is? I know we can. So the real question is will we? Will you join me in this quest? I mean, this is what I do all over the world, is I have this conversation with audiences. And at the end, I ask them to join me, to make a commitment. We call it the performance agreement, that they will perform in a way that makes the performance of those around them better. We're not competing, you know, we're more like a choir. We're trying to blend so that the performance is exceptional. It's one that people want to experience again and again. So I'd invite people to connect with me on LinkedIn, share their thoughts about this podcast, share their thoughts about performance at work, connect on Instagram, wherever. I'm Gregory Offner Jr. I feel like I'm pretty easy to follow or to find. You know, online, there aren't a whole lot of Gregory Offners out there. And just connect with me. That's the thing I'd ask your audience to do. Let me know what it is that they need to develop in their career. And if I can help, I'd be happy to.
Brilliant. Thank you, Gregory. It's been a fascinating talk. And it's, I've got several notes of things that I need to do and check out. And I'm sure I will be, which will allow me to, is going to be used quite a few times over the next few weeks and months, I'm sure. So all I've got to say is thank you very much and have a brilliant rest of your day.
Thanks, Nigel. You too. It's been awesome. Cheers. See you soon.
Cheers, mate.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that second part of that interview with Greg. Fascinating guy, a really interesting story. Next week, we have Lucy Harrison on the show. I have her book behind me, Soft Skills for Tough Jobs. And as a PM, it can be a tough job, and sometimes you need those soft skills. So, speak to you next week. Cheers now. So, this is my final wrap-up. Every week you're going to hear this, you're going to get bored of it, but you can always click next podcast if so. If you have enjoyed it, if you listen to this podcast to the end of this show and you think that was great, I'd love to be able to help Nigel out. There are loads of ways you can do it. The first and obvious way is to share the podcast, send it out to people. If you know colleagues and friends who'd benefit from it, you think they'd enjoy it, just send them the link. Grab one of the links, send them to www.nigelcreaser.com/podcasts. That's www.nigelcreaser.com/podcasts. And that'll push them over to a Linktree link, and it's got all of the different ways they can consume the podcast. If you are feeling generous and have a big bag of cash, you could grab a copy of one of my books. Obviously, they're available in all the usual places, and print and digital. Again, jump on the website, www.nigelcreaser.com/shop, and that will give you a list of all the different ways that you can contribute and grab copies of the book. Also got links to all my guests' books on there as well, where I get a little bit of a kickback from them. If you are of a sporting mind, I have a number through doing some of my judo and running antics. I've managed to secure a few affiliate links and affiliates there as well. So in there, somewhere in the sponsors page, there's links to those as well. So clicking onto those and grabbing if you're looking to get super fit, then that would be fabulous as well, and I get a little kickback from those. I have a Patreon account. It's patreon.com/sundaylunchpm. So again, you can ping something in there, buy me a coffee or whatever. And finally, obviously the most important is coming back, listen again, because the more of you that come back, the more visibility I get, because there's more times that it's downloaded and all the SEO works and things like that. So yeah, that's it. So if you can help me out, I would be much appreciated. If you can't, don't worry about it. Thank you very much. Cheers now. Bye. Well, it's goodbye from me, Nigel Creaser, and it's goodbye from him, the Sunday Lunch PM. Goodbye.